co-sponsor of the Clinton Street Stomp, an evening of unamplified performances by some of the region's root music acts, playing the third Saturday of each month, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the December 19th show features Crow Quill Night Owls, Caleb Plotter and Reeve Wilms, and Miller and Saucer, and hosted by country blues yodeler Zach Bryson. Again, that's the Clinton Street Stomp, Saturday, December 19th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kvu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Sonny Blechinger, KBOO's Artist in Residence for 2015. Hope you'll join us at the Clinton Street Theater December 10th, Thursday night at 7 p.m. for the broadcast of my radio play, The Pool. It's about four swimmers who happen to use the same pool at the same time every week. It'll be broadcast with new video by local filmmaker Lincoln Baron Holmes and hosted by the comedians from American Comedy, Paul Schlesinger and Jason Traeger. Following the radio play will be a screening of the 1968 film The Swimmer, starring Burt Lancaster. Again, that's Thursday night, December 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, SW Conser, and I'm joined in the studio today by three Portland comics artists who have come together to create a graphic novel, the third in the Hereville series. Heading up the team, as always, is writer and artist Barry Deutsch. Barry, welcome back to Words and Pictures.
Thanks. I'm really glad to be back.
And also back for a return visit is background artist Adrian Wallace.
Thank you. It's right glad to be here.
And joining us for the first time, a very warm welcome to colorist extraordinaire Jake Richmond.
I'm very excited to be here.
So I'm very extraordinaire.
So Barry, tell us about the new Hereville book. It's called How Mirka Caught a Fish. We've had you back before talking about the earlier entries in the series, and this one is already getting lots of great advanced press.
So, this time around, Mirka ends up getting stuck babysitting her little sister, Lael.
We're talking about Mirka. She is the heroine of the story.
Right. Mirka is an 11-year-old Orthodox Jewish girl who's obsessed with the idea of becoming a monster-fighting hero.
And she lives in a very sequestered, kind of a cloistered town called Hereville.
Right. It's sort of an intentional community that was created so that they could raise their kids in a fully Jewish community. So, this is not a comic about Judaism. It's certainly not a comic where I'm attempting to teach anyone anything, because I hate that. I don't feel that reading a comic book should make you a better person, because I just don't enjoy that experience as a reader. Right. And Mirka being Jewish is just part of her character and part of the story without it being the focus of the story.
In some ways, the culture that surrounds her is constraining her a little bit from going out and being the wild character that that she might be if she were in a less straight-laced community.
It's constraining her a little bit, but it's also supporting her a little bit. I mean, there's a curious dichotomy there. There's a lot of limitations on Mirka because of the expectations of how she should act, how she should dress. But there's also some freedom in it that wouldn't be familiar in our culture. An anthropologist I read who wrote a book about Hasidic Jewish girls commented that the girls seemed so loud and boisterous and free compared to what she was used to. And a lot of it is that because there's no socializing with boys until much older, there's also no feeling among the girls that the way to be popular is to mold yourself into what you believe the boys like. And there's this kind of all these customs that girls in our culture do without even thinking of it, which are all framed around the way to be a popular and respectable girl is to be at least acknowledge as worthwhile by the boys, whether or not you're interested in dating boys. And that entire set of pressures is entirely absent for Mirka, at least at age 11. Of course, when she gets to be 16 and 17, those same pressures will ratchet up 1,000 times because she'll be having to think about getting married very soon.
So this is one reason why you've been keeping Mirka 11 years old throughout all three books so far.
The trilogy is, I think of it as the Mirka is 11 trilogy.
Okay.
If there are future Hero books, she will be older than 11. But this is sort of, I mean, we've all had that year in our childhoods, which when you look back on it, it just seemed endless. And there seemed to be way too many events happening in a single year. And this is that year for Mirka.
Now, you just had a very successful event here in Portland to roll out the book. It was very well attended, and I'm sure you've done a number of book signings. And I'm just wondering if you get people who mistake you for maybe being somebody who's very, very observant and then are disappointed when they find out that you're a very secular Jew in a very modern town.
Actually, I've kind of heard the opposite reaction at a Jewish school I was speaking at. The librarian told me that when she was telling the kids about me a few days before I turned up, she described the books and asked them to imagine the author. And so they did. And she then showed them my photo, my obviously non-Orthodox photo with my hippie hair and all that. And all the kids, according to the librarian, went, ooh. Because, you know, it was not at all what they were expecting.
Well, she didn't show them your blog or your ampersand comics, which tend to be very queer-friendly, feminist, and, as you yourself say, promoting fat equality.
And fat acceptance. No, I would be surprised if the librarian did show them that, but I actually do think of the Hereville books as being very feminist in intent.
Okay.
They're not going to be preachy, but this is a very female-centric universe. We're going to see not just Mirka, the main character, but a bunch of female characters who are taking really important roles in these stories. Mirka's stepmother, Fruma, the villain in this new book. I mean, this is obviously partly inspired by the Bechdel test, but trying to show a universe in which nearly all the important roles in all the stories are being played by girls.
Alison Bechdel famously said that it was hard to find a movie in which two women are talking to each other about something other than a man.
Right.
So Fruma, the stepmother, she was introduced in the first book, and we get a hint of her backstory, just a hint. The first book being how Mirka got her sword. And then you take us completely through book two without any payoff about that hint. But here in book three, in how Mirka caught a fish, you are giving us some of Mirka's stepmother's background, and it has to do with time travel.
Well, Mirka gets to travel through time in a way. She gets a magical device, as she does in each of these stories. It's, I think, my childhood obsession with E. Nesbitt is showing up in the plotting of Hereville. There's always some central magical object or being that sets the plot in motion in each book. In this book, she gets a magical hairband, which allows her to not actually interact with the past, but to travel into the past and witness important events there. And what she witnesses is Fruma, when Fruma was about Mirka's age in the late 1970s, and she discovers the clues to a evil magical fish that's bothering her and her younger sister today, are all in these events that happened to Fruma when Fruma was 11.
Ah, very cool.
A lot of fantasy adventure. You can feel the editor or the writing teacher or someone hanging over the writer's shoulder going, raise the stakes, raise the stakes. And somehow that means in the ending, it's always the world at stake that's going to be destroyed. And there's always big explosions. And a lot of that stuff ends up being very boring. So one thing I like about Hereville is that often the stakes are relatively small. You know, in the second book, the big stakes were that Mirka might be thrown out of Hereville. In the third book, the stakes are that her little sister has been kidnapped by a magical fish, which is very large stakes, but I wanted to be able to have big, important stakes that weren't the world is ending stakes.
Well, when Mirka goes back home at the end of each adventure, I mean, she's back home in this very protected household, but she's a little bit more adept, just internally more adept.
Well, she lives. She learns.
Maybe she learns. She's stubborn. I mean, there's always this conflict between me, Barry the writer, and Mirka the character, because Mirka has this ambition to solve things violently. You know, she wants to take her sword and stab something. And, you know, the first book was all about getting the sword. She's never used it. But Barry the writer wants the solutions to the books to usually end up being nonviolent, and for Mirka to have to grow in terms of her ability to feel empathy and for other people, and for that to be integral to how each book resolves and still form a satisfying adventure and ending. So I feel that Mirka and I are always in conflict that way.
So let's talk with a couple of your collaborators here. You brought Jake Richmond on board early on.
Jake has been with me since the first book.
Okay.
The original webcomic I colored myself, and then when Abrams signed me up to expand it into a graphic novel, in order to basically help me make my schedule, I brought in Jake as a collaborator. And Jake's done a wonderful job with the completely unreasonable demands I make of him.
Yeah, so Jake, what was the way that you tackled the colors? You were not just looking to color the world in kind of a realistic way, but in a way that also reflected kind of the tenor of the story.
Well, I should point out that I was a big fan of Heroville before I worked on the project. I first met Barry around the time that he was starting the webcomic, and I really liked it, and I got to see him growing the webcomic and completing the story in that way. I don't want to take a lot of credit for the colors of Heroville because Barry's colors in the webcomic were very distinctive and very iconic. And we talked about the first book before I started, and he made it clear that he wanted me to continue that tradition. He chose the color palettes. And what I did was I basically colored at Barry's direction.
And I'm going to disagree. Jake, you lying bastard.
Well, all right.
I picked the palettes and the aesthetic idea, the way that all Heroville books use a very limited color palette and then will suddenly switch color palettes to indicate a change in mood or in scene. But the actual decision-making on a panel-to-panel, page-to-page basis is almost all Jake's. Jake is the one who, like, you have six colors, and you have to make a world out of this, and you have to make sure that all these objects pop out from their backgrounds. That's all on Jake, and it's hard work, and he does a wonderful job.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today about the third entry in the Heroville series of graphic novels, How Mirka Caught a Fish. Artist and author Barry Deutsch is here in the studio, along with fellow artists Jake Richmond and Adrian Wallace.
And Jake, I should mention, also is an influence on the stories. In all three books, especially the second and third books, Jake was part of a comics critique group, and so was Adrian. But I think Jake was a more frequent person there.
We don't
listen. Later on. Yeah.
We don't really listen to what Adrian ever has to say.
At every stage of the Heroville books, the plotting, the scripts, and later on the layouts and rough pencils, I would bring it to the group, and Jake is definitely a voice I listen to. He influences a story, the ending of book two, the spoilers ahead, the idea of having Mirka actually wind up in outer space was suggested to me by Jake. And Jake is also a very good voice for what doesn't work. In the pencils, in the very rough pencils for book three, Jake looked at the pencils for Lael, the six-year-old sister. And I was doing a very bad job of penciling Lael because I was being lazy and not sitting down and saying, okay, how do I make a six-year-old work? And I remember the way Jake phrased his critique still, which is, have you ever seen a child? That was a good wake-up call.
So. I felt like such a jerk for that afterwards.
No, that was
too.
Great. There's a bunch of differences that I just hadn't taken the time to sit down and defeat my usual drawing reflexes and make them into something that suited this character better.
What's really neat about Lael in the third book is how different she is from Mirka. I mean, they're both children. They are not so separated in age. Mirka is several years older, but they both have very different body types. They both move in different ways. They are very, very different people. I have a bad habit of when I draw children in my comic, I have like one stock child that I just draw over and over again with different heads, and Barry completely got around that and made her a very distinctive visual character.
And we want to talk about your personal comic in a moment, but we also want to bring into the conversation Adrian Wallace, who managed to really nail your style, Barry, in doing backgrounds and
my style, but better drawn.
I just sort of took Barry's style and just crammed a lot more stuff in there, it seems.
Yeah, no, the quality of the drawing in this is so improved by having collaborators, because, I mean, this book took 2.5 years to complete, and without these two, it would not have looked as good and would have taken 6 years.
And Adrian has his Jumbo Deluxe comic, which is always packed with details and architecture. Is that what, when you looked at that, did you say, I want this guy on my book?
Well, of course, that was it. It's also, I'd known Adrian for a couple of years by then, so.
Yeah, I think it was like, you'd like asked me if you like knew anybody who wanted to draw backgrounds, and I said, well, hey, I've got nothing better to do. I'll give it a go. So I came along one day, and you said, here, draw some backgrounds for this page, and we'll see how it goes. So I was just trying to copy the way you drew trees and houses and things like that.
Right, I gave Adrian the penciled figures and the word balloons, and he did such beautiful, detailed backgrounds that I actually erased the characters in one panel, which had been like a close-up of Mirka and Lael with their heads filling up 80% of the panel, and said, okay, I'm going to set them all the way across the street, and so that they'll be tiny, full figures so that we won't cover up the beautiful telephone pole that Adrian has drawn.
I remember when you gave me the first page that Adrian had drew, I looked at it and I was like, ugh. Oh my god, this is going to take like 5 times as long to color, which was true throughout the entire thing. This Hereville took me 4 to 5 times longer to complete than the previous two Herevilles.
I think part of the reason for that too is the story takes place in mid-October, and so there's like hundreds of leaves falling off the trees everywhere you go, and like every time a character is moving, they're always followed by about a dozen or so leaves,
which is beautiful, by the
way. Every one of which I drew, and every one of which Jake colored.
For me, the real pleasure in collaborating is, I mean, both of them think that they're imitating my style to some degree, but to a great extent they fail, and for me, that's when things get interesting. When I get a colored Hereville page from Jake, and he does something amazing that it never would have occurred to me to do. You know, at an important emotional moment where you have a panel that's just a close-up of a character's face, Jake might decide, okay, I'm going to just use a completely different color for this than I would use in any other circumstance. And it's great, and it's so cool, and it wouldn't have occurred to me. And Adrian as well. In this new book, I laid out this whole book in stick figure form before Adrian came on board the project. Which makes me feel better, because there are some pages which are so hard on Adrian. And honestly, my intention when I laid it out and wrote it was that I would draw it, which is the only thing I'm hoping that will save me from being condemned to hell for what I put Adrian through in some of this. Page 100 especially, I think pages 100 and 101, I didn't actually draw anything on. They were all Adrian and Jake. I think I lettered a sound effect, and that's it. But, you know, Adrian, during a big underwater sequence at the end...
Spoilers, everybody.
...decided... I told Adrian that, you know, he could decide what went in the background himself. I just had a couple of requests. And he drew all these, like, big metal gears embedded in the walls of this underwater cave. And there's just so much cool stuff there, which looks great, and which it wouldn't have occurred to me to do. And for me, that's a lot of the joy of this collaborative process, is being surprised by looking at a page of what is at one level my own work and going, oh, this is so great. I wouldn't even have thought of that. It's so fun to be able to look at it and have that feeling of a textured reality that you could just walk into. And you should talk about this a bit.
Well, that whole sense of a world that these characters live in, I think that's always been really important to me as a comics reader. You know, I've always been attracted to the kind of books that really give you a sense of place and a sense of time when the story takes place. And sometimes it's just these little background details that you may not be consciously aware of, but they all kind of add up somewhere in the back of your mind that give you kind of this greater picture of what's going on. And I've always been really attracted to those kind of books where you can tell like the artists were really thinking about everything in this world, everything that was going on, even if it's a world not unlike our own. Like, you know, if it was just say the world of like the 1970s or the 1980s, something that wasn't really that long ago, but they'd really thought about it and really gotten all these details. So it's very, you know.
And a sense of place is really important for these books in particular. Mirka as a character could only exist within this community. These stories could only take place within this community. And so having it there is important. And a lot of details like the economic class of the characters is really only communicated in the drawings. It's not something that an 11-year-old girl who's from a middle-class household that's a little stressed for money, you know, she doesn't think about money a lot because, you know, it's not really her job in the family to think about it. So it shows in things like their slightly beat up years old car and details like that. And that's the kind of things that even if readers aren't consciously aware of when they read the comic, I think it makes a real difference to their experience and lets them know what kind of family they're looking at. Jake, what was your most challenging page?
Oh, my God. Any of the giant pages with a million fish on them, I think.
There were a few pages which had zillions of tiny fish in them, each of which was individually drawn. And that was definitely, for me, the most challenging page.
So you didn't just, like, draw, like, a few fish and then just clone them? And
No. I drew every cheating. Single fish one at a time.
To his credit, these are hundreds and
I didn't want
individual
them.
Fish.
I mean, when I read a comic and there's a page like that, I always check to see if I can notice cloned fish, so.
Okay.
Or cloned whatever, so.
Well, I think all three of you have one thing in common.
Beards.
Yeah, beards. Yeah. Well, one of the things.
Dudes.
Yeah. One of the things that all three of you have in common is you like to mash up literature and mythology and domestic scenes, put that all into your web comics, and, well, Jake's big web comic is called Modest Medusa, and actually you were featured.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, you were featured at the Portland Art Museum during a recent event called the Mythos Challenge and Modest Medusa. Tell us a little bit about Modest Medusa. Modest Medusa shows up in a household that looks oddly like your household with somebody named Jake who looks a bit like you.
It's true. Modest Medusa started as an anger comic. I was at a convention. And I came home, and my bathroom had flooded and destroyed my living space in the house I share with several friends. And I was so angry that I walked out of the house, and I walked to the studio where I lived, and I made this comic about this toilet overflowing. But I wasn't sure where to go with it next, so I decided that this little Medusa came out of it. And I liked that so much that I just kept doing it, and now that's what I do mostly for a living. Modest is 5 years old. She is a snake girl, a Medusa from a magical land. She comes to our world completely by accident and meets a family, not really a family, but a guy named Jake, who is me, and his niece, Mara, who is my niece. And so Modest Medusa became a comic about just this Medusa that lives with me, and I didn't really have a place for it to go till one day I decided what I really wanted it to be was this adventure comic about these two girls who have to rescue their friends. So late in the comic, Jake gets sucked into a toilet into the magical world, and Medusa and Mara have to go on this epic quest to rescue him, and the comic for 2 years became this kind of hard fantasy comic about the girls going on this amazing quest, and then it shifted and for a little bit became a prison drama. And I've decided what I like to do is just about every year and a half kind of shift what the comic is. I'm coming up on my 5th year right now, and I'm getting ready for another big shift.
You've branched out into another couple of web comics that you do that are not as frequent, but definitely reaching for different heights.
Yeah. I recently, just a few months ago, started a science fiction and comic magazine called Combine, which features three different comics, one by myself, which is called Ghost Kiss, which is a superhero comic about a woman who has a very kind of unfortunate power that lets her, when she kisses people, they completely forget who she is. So she has trouble using this as a superpower. She has to be very creative. But what it also means is she has a lot of people in her life who are important to her that no longer remember who she is at all.
That's a little Men in Black in some sense.
Yeah. Well, and it's a really problematic power. She keeps, in the first story I did, she keeps running into people who she's dated in the past or who she's made out with or who she's accidentally kissed. As the story goes on, we'll find out that her mother no longer remembers who she is.
Ouch.
Yeah. The person she was first in love with has no idea who she is and stuff like that. She also has to go to great lengths to use her powers in really creative ways. I wanted to do a comic book about a superhero that was kind of like it was a funny comic. It wasn't really an action comic, but it had some action elements to it. But a superhero who really got stuck with an unfortunate power and really tries hard to use it to actually do superhero stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay, that sounds pretty entertaining. So, Adrian, now that you've been stretching your art muscles in another artist's world, are you itching to get back and do some of your own world creating there?
Yeah, I've been writing a bunch more scripts for some new Jumbo Deluxe comics. So there will be some more of those coming down the pipe. Probably starting in the new year, I'll be getting some new stuff out there. And the story will pick up from where it left off, too. So there's been, like, this car chase going on for, like, the last 3 years, and we don't know what's going to happen to them. So we will get a resolution on that soon.
Okay, the book is called Hereville, How Mirka Caught a Fish. It's the third in the Hereville series of graphic novels. The creator is Barry Deutsch. Barry, thanks for joining us once again on Words and Pictures.
Thanks for having me again. I always love being here.
And thanks also to your able assistants, Jake Richmond and Adrian Wallace. Great to have you both in the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
So, Barry, where can people find a copy of Hereville, How Mirka Caught a Fish?
You can find a copy of Hereville anywhere that books are sold and many places that comic books are sold. Comic book stores, some of them are great and really stock it. Others are like, Jewish girl, no one's going to buy this. But any bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, IndieBound, also Comixology if you prefer digital copies, and also copies for the Nook on Barnes & Noble and copies for whatever Amazon's format is on Amazon. So any place you buy a book, Hereville is there.
Could we do a shout out for the Sprightly Bean?
Oh, absolutely. If you're in Portland,
find it at the Sprightly Bean.
The Sprightly Bean, which is on Southeast Powell and is an awesome comics and coffee shop. And their selection of comics is very eclectic and is emphasizing really unusual and independent comics.
And listeners might also want to check out your website and blog.
My website is at www.hereville.com. And you can find links to all my various other things at amptoons.com, which is amptoons.com.
And as for Jake and Adrian, how can people find out more about you and your various books and projects?
You can see my garbage at jumbodeluxe.com. And I'm also on the Twitters. So
your beautiful, intricately drawn garbage
that I hardly ever update. Yeah, that's all at jumbodeluxe.com.
You can find anything you want to know about me by Googling Modest Medusa. It's my website is the first thing that comes up. It's really easy to find. Modestmedusa.com.
For that matter, if you can't remember Hereville.com, Google Jewish Girl Comic Book. It'll come up.
Nice. All right. Thanks, everybody. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. You can find an archived version of the show later today at KBOO.FM/words and pictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Thursday, December 10th, 2015. I'm John Shuck. The state of Oregon took a dive in America's health rankings from 12th to 20th place for 2015. In a report released today from the United Health Foundation, Oregon's drop is due to an increase in child poverty, which affects 20% of youth in the state. Other factors contributing to the lower ranking are a disparity in health in relation to education level and increasing cases of whooping cough. In national news, Donald Trump is not receiving a hometown welcome for his comments about Muslims. A rally was held on the steps of the New York City Hall Wednesday, condemning the GOP presidential candidate for his proposed ban on Muslims entering the country. Imam Khalid Latif of the NYU Islamic Center said that the anti-Muslim backlash is worse than after September 11th and is fueled by anti-Islamic sentiment from politicians like Trump and Ben Carson. Elected officials and religious leaders called for New Yorkers to speak up and denounce the hatred. Donald Trump is from Queens. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, speaking on the Senate floor on Monday, said in regards to Trump's plan,
"This is the single worst idea that I have heard from any presidential candidate ever."
Trump is even too much for Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu. In response to Netanyahu's criticisms of Trump's comments about Muslims, Trump today canceled his trip to Israel. Meanwhile, the International Middle East Media Center reports that Israeli soldiers kidnapped 9 Palestinians today and yesterday. The Graduate Student Association at the University of California, Los Angeles is under fire. In October, the graduate student government at the school agreed to fund an event on diversity, but on the condition that the gathering had no connection to the movement to divest from companies linked to